What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
Screen Time with John Farty.
Brought to you by Stella Cinemas. Spoil yourself in a truly unique cinematic experience.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Farty. This is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Oscar-winning composer Ludwig Göransson, who scored everything from Tenet to The Mandalorian. The cinemas are closed again, I'm afraid, but there's a great new movie on Netflix that launched this weekend called The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and myself and Mark Ryle will be telling you all about that, plus the one and only Francis Brennan on his favourite movie. I'm open on Twitter, John_Farty, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the News Talk app, or wherever you choose to get your podcasts, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on the aforementioned News Talk. Good weekend to you all. I have to start, obviously, with the cinemas being closed again. I don't know why I even have a laugh in my voice. There's nothing funny about it. All over the country, as of earlier in the week, we're on level 3. It's a crying shame. I'm not complaining about it. It had to be done. But, you know, aside from like people in Cineworld actually losing their jobs and just the knock-on effect of something like cinemas being closed, it's terrible for all sorts of people. And, you know, in particular, because I know a lot of them, I feel really bad for filmmakers and tech ops and people who are invested in the creative product that they've, you know, a movie can take 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from conception to get to the screen. And I think it's something like Rialto, a new movie that we talked about last week, you know, written by Mark O'Halloran, starring Tom Von Lawler, you know, people's lives who've created that are wound up in that for a long time, and then for it to be delayed and shown for a few days and then taken. It's really tough going. But look, we can't go on, we must go on and all that, and we will go to the cinema again. And I've said it before, you know, we're all going to be encouraged to, you know, shop local and buy local and try and put our money back into certain places that need it. So when all this settles, please go back to the cinema. We really need people back in cinemas once it's safe to go back there. So think about doing that. Lecture over. Now, this week I was watching this.
What I want people to know is that everything they're doing online is being watched, is being tracked, is being measured. Every single action you take is carefully monitored and recorded. Exactly what image you stop and look at, for how long you look at it. Oh yeah, seriously, for how long you look at it.
They know when people are lonely, they know when people are depressed, they know when people are looking at photos of your ex-romantic partners, they know what you're doing late at night, they know the entire thing.
Now that's a clip from a Netflix movie, I think it's on about 2 weeks, a Netflix documentary called The Social Dilemma. And as you heard from the clip there, it's kind of about big social media companies and their manipulation of algorithms that encourage basically addiction to their platform. And it shows, I think fairly accurately, how personal data, our personal data, has been used to target us with ads. And there's a great phrase in it somewhere, there's a lot of good quotes in it, that the only two businesses in the world that refer to their customers as users are the drug business and social media, which I think is quite telling. And, you know, a lot of this stuff has gone unregulated. And in The Social Dilemma, you have pretty big hitters who were formerly in these tech companies. You have the founder of Pinterest, for instance, and you have some kind of Harvard professors, and they throw around phrases like surveillance capitalism. And it's pretty good and pretty scary. As I say, they have good heavy hitters in it to talk about just how manipulated our social media causes us to be. Now, some of the social media companies have come out and completely said none of this is the case and it's over sensationalized. They would say that. I'm not saying everything is accurate in this documentary. It is very broad brush strokes, but it's certainly a frightening watch. And I found myself putting my phone away and not checking stuff for certainly a while afterwards. I don't know how long that lasted, But it certainly gave me pause for thought. That said, the social dilemma is somewhat ruined by this bizarre docudrama vibe they have going on, because all through it, you have this American family, like fictionalized, acted out, and they're struggling with their smartphones and they're being locked away and someone's breaking into this case to try and get it. And it's just the most hammy kind of like, you know, real life TV they're going for that just kind of ruins it, to be honest. Because it's a decent documentary that gives you pause for thought, and smack in the middle of it is this kind of fictionalized American family talking about their struggle to, or dealing with their struggle to their smartphones. It kind of ruined it for me. Love to know what you thought. The Social Dilemma on Netflix, now streaming. You can get in touch, John_Fardy, or email me, screentime@newstalk.com. Lots of you got in touch last week. A couple of you texted the radio show on 53106, which you're always welcome to do between 6 and 7. I was talking about the Comey rule. Paul and Kildare said, I watched it all in one sitting. Daniels and Gleeson are brilliant. Indeed they are. Sorkin also directed brilliant TV series The Newsroom, also with Jeff Daniels. Paul, I was aware of that, and I don't mean that as... I knew that too, you know, but you're dead right. The Newsroom is brilliant TV as well. And I think is on the Skybox, or... it's certainly out there. The Newsroom is great, as is the Comey rule. And then I got this delightful text from a girl called Kina, who says, I love 12A movies. I watch them a lot. I'm 9 years of age, but I'm texting on my dad's phone. Well, I hope your dad knows, Kina. And thank you for the lovely text. Now, briefly also on TV, I wanted to mention Lodging with Lucy. This is Lucy Kennedy's, I guess, COVID version of Living with Lucy, where the celebrities go to this lodge that Virgin Media have rented out or whatever, and they have a chef, and Lucy meets the guests there. And what I liked about it this week, it was colleagues of mine, I know them loosely, I suppose, Mario Rosenstock and Ian Dempsey, and they both came to lodge with Lucy. And what I really liked about it was just an insight into their friendship and working relationship. Mario and Ian have been together for, I don't know, 22 years, I think it is. And you just saw that kind of creative working relationship at play. And it was kind of delightful. They clearly love each other. And they said that. And there was funny moments. Obviously, Mario is always funny doing his impressions. But there was funny moments when Lucy asked, you know, do you socialise together? And Mario was pointing out, you know, we spend Monday to Friday living together. The idea of going out on a Saturday night just seems a bit strange. So I really enjoyed it, Lodging with Lucy with Ian and Mario this week. Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, we mentioned at the start of the show, obviously all cinemas are closed again, and that's disappointing. But there are still movies being released, and one of them is a fascinating movie, I thought, that lands on Netflix this Friday, the 9th of October. It's called The 40-Year-Old Virgin. That's right, a version. Clearly, kind of... take on The 40-Year-Old Virgin by Judd Apatow. This is something very different, but something that isn't very different. That is Mark Ryle. Mark, hello.
Hey, John. I'm getting further to the ground with every minute.
You're constant as the Northern Star, as Joni Mitchell sang. Do people quote Joni Mitchell lyrics at you often?
Only you.
Yeah, I thought so. Well, let's keep it that way, okay? It can be our thing, amongst our many other things. Okay, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, it's on Netflix. It's in black and white, but don't let that put you off. I really like this, but tell people what's going on here.
I would describe it as Curb Your Enthusiasm without the success and the obscene wealth, I suppose. I suppose there's three different strands going on here. Radha Blank writes, directs, and takes the lead here, playing a semi-fictional version of herself. She is actually a playwright, but she didn't, as far as I know, win the prestigious 30 Under 30 Award 10 years ago. But however, she is in the position where she has kind of failed to live up to the promise of her early career. And she, now 3 months shy of 40, she is dealing with some major life crises. To make the rent, she is teaching youth theatre to a bunch of unruly Harlem students with, I'd say, negligible degrees of success. She is also trying to get her new play about the gentrification of Harlem to the stage, but the only option that is open to her is to go with this borderline predator, race, tourist, theatre producer who's more interested in schooling Radha in how to write the Black experience and to rewrite her play as misery porn. And then if all that wasn't enough, she is also decided to reinvent herself as a rapper called Radimus Prime. So that is what's going on in the 40-year-old version.
And as you say, just to clarify, this is kind of a fictionalized version of herself. I mean, the character is called Radha Blank, which is her name in real life. And she is a woman who's written and directed and had some success, but possibly not a huge amount. So it's close enough to her own life, but obviously exaggerated for comic and dramatic effect.
And it was also written, I think, just after her mother passed away. So there's many parallels.
Yeah, and I was going to say about that, because your Curb Your Enthusiasm analogy is a good one, but there's probably slightly more heart and poignancy in this because she is dealing with stuff like the death of her mother and at one point is crying out for her mother.
Mm, exactly, yeah. I think what this does really, really well is to take a long, hard look at the reality of being a working artist, you know, with constant sacrifices and the compromises and the necessity of sometimes you just have to sell out. And it is an underdog story, but it doesn't resort to schmaltz, and it satisfies your emotional investment without falling back on the usual triumph over adversity cliches, and all the while it still manages to be hilarious. I think
it's really funny.
It really is, yeah. She's got a very, very strong, very original voice, but she's also got terrific comic timing. And if the script is occasionally a bit flaky and perhaps improbable, she gets away with it. She's got a terrific ear for comedy dialogue, and not only are the jokes razor sharp, but I think her delivery is faultless. It's seriously funny, yeah.
And much of the humor, or certainly part of the humor, is when she makes this kind of odd, you know, dive towards rap, that she's going to become a rap artist or a hip hop artist. And she goes to this place in somewhere in Brooklyn and meets this producer and, you know, possibly begins some kind of, you know, unexpected relationship with him. But a lot of the humor comes from, you know, people's almost disbelief at the fact that she's suddenly going to start rapping and hip hopping. And she has this wonderful, you know, comic gift that she seems to self-sabotage some of her success at times. And there's a hilarious scene where she goes on stage having imbibed some narcotics and her rap and hip hop just falls apart. And it was one of the funniest things I've seen in a long time. I'm laughing just thinking about it.
Laughing and cringing.
Yes, exactly. There's a lot of between the fingers moments, which I love, and it's that kind of Curb Your Enthusiasm thing. But I also want to say the hip hop and the rap is actually quite good once you get into it. And some of the rhymes are very well thought out. Now, I don't know what you thought. I don't know if you're a hip hop kind of guy, but to my limited knowledge of it, she's pretty good at it.
Yeah, I would say my knowledge of hip hop would be, I described as limited. I think if you don't know what you're talking about, then it's probably best to keep your mouth shut. But obviously, like, when things aren't going well, it probably isn't the best idea to take up a career in hip hop.
And another couple of things that are cool about it, she's in this school in Harlem, you know, working with these kids who are vaguely interested in writing a play, and some of them have problems of their own, but there's some great interactions there, and they have to write a play with her, and some of the suggestions of what they're going to write the play about again are laugh out loud hilarious.
Yeah, I know. On the theatre thing, if we just want to touch on this producer that she is kind of tied to unwillingly, who keeps on, you know, suggesting, well, if you don't want to follow my suggestions for rewrites, I'm still looking for a writer for the Harriet Tubman musical. He seems to have this endless selection of musicals involving historical figures. But what I think what's going on there is he's acting as this kind of cultural gatekeeper. And he is, what it does is that it shows how, I suppose, Black artists and Black stories get manipulated into something that's less honest and more in line with the level of inclusion that he is comfortable with. And what he's actually doing is he is gentrifying her play about gentrification.
Yeah.
Which is really ironic. But I mean, it's all done with humor. I think if you're going to start poking at things like that, that's the best way of addressing it. What I think what it's really, really good at is it takes this, obviously a series of endless no's and knockbacks, and she's changed the rules and she's turned it into a win because obviously Rada Blank is a woman of color. She's also 40, which in Hollywood years, that's, you know, that's near death. And there are probably limited roles available for an actor of her status and her stature. And they would all be, you know, bit parts as Anne Hathaway's sassy friend in some terrible rom-com. But here she's written and she's directed a movie for herself that really plays to her strengths, which are formidable. And she's done it on her own terms and it's paid off to the extent that she actually won the Best Directing Award back at this year's Sundance in February, if you can cast your mind back to February. They were good times, weren't they?
They were good times. I could see a storm brewing, though. But one final thing on it, what I really like about it as well, the way it looks, it's in black and white. It feels like a kind of Spike Lee movie from the 80s, or dare I even say it, some of Woody Allen's classic movies from the 80s, because it's very New York. It's very, it's that New York where you can just be walking down the street and you'll bump into some ridiculous character on a sidewalk. And it's just great.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think it's a very, very New York movie. And I think the setting is as much a part of the story as the characters are. And yeah, shooting it in black and white obviously brings to mind Spike Lee and Woody Allen. But then you get these really strong inserts of color when she's thinking about her mother and flashing back to her mother's work, who was a visual artist. So yeah, it's a singular look, and it's just a, she's got a fantastic original voice, and it's really funny.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I think as much as I did. So stars time. What are you going to say stars wise?
I'm going to give it a 4. What do
Wonderful.
You think?
I'm going to give it a 4 as well. So that's the 40-year-old version on Netflix from the 9th of October. The cinemas may be closed, but there is hope for movies, because based on the 40-year-old version, there's a lot of good movies still being made despite the madness. And there's a lot of good movie reviews coming your way still. Compliments of Mark Ryle. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, John.
Remember this face? She was one of Spotlight Magazine's 30 Under 30 playwrights to watch. We watched, but where'd she go?
I want to make a mixtape about the 40-year-old woman's point of view.
Why my skin so dry? Why am I yawning right now? This is 40.
And that was a clip there from the 40-year-old version, available on Netflix as of the 9th of October. And it really is good. It kind of cheered me up. Not that I was in a particularly bad mood or anything, but, you know, I'm a sunny kind of guy. But it was just, I love those kind of movies, those aped black and white movies in New York, where anything can happen in New York. I think it's great. So let me know if you get around to watching the 40-year-old version. Up next, I'm going to be talking to Ludwig Göransson. I hear you ask, who is he? Well, he is a man who has scored just about every recent movie and has won Oscars and also Emmys and Grammys. Stay tuned for that.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Brought to you by Stella Cinemas. Spoil yourself in a truly unique cinematic experience.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, Ludwig Göransson is possibly not a name you know, but he is one of the hardest working and indeed most successful film composers and score writers out there. He has done everything from, most recently, Tenet. There's brilliant music in Tenet. The movies, you know, we've discussed it ad nauseum on this show. Complicated, let's say, as much as I enjoyed it. And the music works brilliantly in it. He recently won an Emmy, like a couple of weeks ago, for The Mandalorian, which the music is one of the best things about that TV show. He did Black Panther. He did the Creed movies. This guy's got serious game. As I said, he's won an Oscar. He's won a Grammy. He's won an Emmy. If he should do a Broadway musical, he would be one of the few people, if he won a Tony, to be one of those EGOT people. But anyway, that's a while off. I had a word with Ludwig earlier in the week. So Ludwig, I suppose the thing that strikes a lot of people when they watch Tenet, certainly me, was how complicated it is. It's a fantastic movie. It's not like anything I've seen in a long time. But I was confused at times. And I'm wondering, when you sit down to write a score, does that kind of stuff bleed into you? Are you thinking, I gotta convey the confusion in that, or maybe it doesn't work that way at all?
To me, I think that the fantastic thing about the way Chris makes movies is that they are so conceptually ambitious, and I think they're inviting you to immerse yourself in the story and in the complex world that he has created, and it's always about the depth of the experience. And you can, I feel like I can just truly sit back and enjoy the ride. And one of my goals in composing the music for Tenet was to underscore the emotional roadmap and help fully submerge the audience in this incredible adventure.
I suppose you're playing handmade to the story. You're not trying to necessarily reflect any of that complicated narrative structure.
I'm definitely reflecting the narrative of the movie and the story of the movie. And I feel like the music is just enhancing the experience of feeling with the protagonist. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, when I read the script and when I also saw the images for the first time, it's something I never quite experienced before. And you're experiencing it from the protagonist's point of view. So I think it's probably halfway through the movie, he's walking out when he's inverted, and you're sitting there and you experience yourself. It's almost like you experience it being inverted yourself. So mm-hmm. what me and Chris did from, you know, 1.5 years ago, we worked on this for a long time, was to create this unique sound world of feeling like you're inverted. And it's jarring, and it's something you haven't heard before, and it's something you haven't experienced, and you don't know what the sounds are. You can't, like, the it's, from my point of view, the music is, I manipulated it so you can't really tell what's organic or what's electronic and what's backwards and what's forwards.
Right.
So it's a very, I think the first viewing experience is just so jarring because it's not what you expect to hear.
That's fascinating. And so, you know, did he take you out to dinner or ask to meet you and say, in essence, I've this movie and it's like nothing you've ever seen before. I want a certain kind of music. Like, were you expecting something very unusual before you saw it? Because as you say, it is a very unusual movie.
Yeah. Well, the first meeting we had was just us sitting in he invited me to his office, and we were just sitting in his studio playing music to each other. He played me music that inspired him and his career, and I played music that inspired my life. And that was our first meeting. And he kind of ended that meeting. It's like, hey, do you want to come by tomorrow and read the script for my new project? And I went back the day after. I read the script. We had a conversation. And something that struck me immediately was just how interested he was in hearing my ideas on how we can push the boundaries in and how we can experiment with sounds and production to create these kind of new ways about music and sound design that you haven't really been exposed to in film before.
And can I just ask you, when you sit down with Christopher Nolan or anyone really, and you're playing them a selection of music that's inspired you over the years, could you name maybe two as an example of pieces of music that got you and made you start on a road of music?
Ooh. You know, one thing that I was extremely interested in, because the subject of the movie is about inversion, and one thing that I played, I love Bach, and he was one of the original composers to start inverting music, and so I remember playing some snippets of like, I think it's the Crab Canon by Bach that is music played forwards and then backwards. And then there's another artist that I played, and his name is Little Snake, and he's from Canada. He's a 20-year-old artist, and the sounds that the music that he makes, it's very sound heavy. So it's more focused on sound design. And the way that he creates the sounds in his music is in a completely new way that I haven't heard before. And he's using technology to kind of reverse and inverse music. And to me, it's like the combination of old and new and how you can combine that together using technology, but also using the old school and theory and harmony. And how you can combine that and create something completely new. That's what's interesting to me.
Yeah. since I think I was meant to talk to you 3 weeks ago, and I'm glad we're talking now because I can congratulate you on another award, an Emmy.
Thank you.
And I was delighted that it was for The Mandalorian. I am a child of Star Wars. Empire Strikes Back was the first movie I ever went to. And I said this on my show a couple of weeks ago that I think The Mandalorian, and it's no disrespect to any of the other movies, but The Mandalorian is the closest to the vibe and the sheer joy, for want of a better phrase, of the first three Star Wars movies that I fell in love with as a kid. And the music is a big part of that. And I'm wondering, were you a child of Star Wars as well? And did that affect the great music you wrote for Mandalorian?
Of course, yeah. I experienced Star Wars through the music first. I was like about 9 or 10 and I heard the music for Star Wars, and that sucked me into that universe. I immediately watched the movies, and the movies and the music, just listening to the music from those, from the original movies, made me feel like I'm on a different planet. I'm in a different universe. And to me, that's what I was trying to connect with when I was writing the music for The Mandalorian. I was trying to connect with my inner child. And so when I started writing music, I took a step back from away from the computer. That's normally how I write most of my music, by the computer, but I took a step away from the computer and just surrounded myself with instruments that I used to play when I was 9 and 10, like the recorders, the piano, guitar, and I was just surrounding myself with these instruments in my studio for a month and just kind of played instruments and recorded them in the way I used to as a child.
You hit it perfectly, I have to say. The music is one of the things that I love about The Mandalorian. Can I just ask you one other soundtrack or score question? You did Creed, of course, and this is a descendant again of Rocky, which has one of the most famous film scores of all time. Does a part of you sit down and go, oh God, this is going to be tough going? Or were you able to, because the soundtrack in Creed kind of invokes the previous Rocky song. Was that a hard one to do?
Yeah, I mean, it was hard, but I was lucky enough to work with, you know, on Creed, I worked with Ryan Coogler, the director, and he, from the get-go, he was like, let's try something new. You know, he kind of opened up the world for me in terms of like, just let me do what felt right to me, and he didn't hold me down that we have to use this or we have to make it sound like that. You know, it was from the get-go, it was such an open collaboration to try to create something new. And it's through those collaborations you had. I mean, I had that with Jon Favreau as well on Star Wars, on Mandalorian. Like, we wanted to do something new. And then, you know, obviously with Mr. Nolan, you know, we were able, that was a whole new concept. By working with directors that really pushes you and are really open to your ideas and excited about creating new art. That, to me, I've been fortunate enough to work with those directors.
Yeah. Well, and finally then, you have an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar. So you just need a Tony to be in the fabled EGOT. Is that something in your future, composing for Broadway or even a stage in Sweden or somewhere? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. When is Broadway going to open again?
Yeah, I know. Hopefully soon.
Hopefully we can get that to happen first.
Yeah.
What I love about film scoring and writing music for film is that you get to dabble around in every kind of genre. And I love working in, that's why I love doing music, because I love working with so many different people and meet new people and learn so much new things. But we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as you say, Broadway has to open first. Well, listen, continued success. And thanks very much for talking to me. I really enjoyed talking to you, Ludwig.
Yeah, no, I had a great time.
Intriguing score from Tenet, and you heard me there talking to its composer, Ludwig Göransson, talking to me about his varied career and all the movies and indeed TV shows he has scored over the years. And I imagine you will hear a lot more of his music. Interesting guy. Up next, the one and only Francis Brennan on his favourite movie.
Screen Time.
on News Talk.
Brought to you by Stella Cinemas. Spoil yourself in a truly unique cinematic experience.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where we talk to someone well known about their favourite movie. And I'm delighted now to be joined by Francis Brennan, a man who needs no introduction. Francis, how are you?
Great, and hello from the kingdom. Are you all well up there in the big city?
We're surviving. We wish we were in the kingdom. Well, some of us do, you know.
Yeah.
But listen, your movie choice is fascinating. In a million years, I never would have guessed that this is what your... I don't know what I thought your favourite movie would be, but I didn't think it would be this. So tell our listeners what your favourite film is.
Well, one of my very favourite films, and I've watched it many times, is A River Runs Through It by Robert Redford.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm sure you know it, do you?
But remind our listeners what it's about again.
Yeah, it's about two brothers and their conflict together growing up under a very strict dad out in, I think it's Montana, if I'm not mistaken, all right?
Yeah.
Where they live. He's a pastor and he's very strict on them. One is a rogue, which is Brad Pitt, and the other lad is very studious and straight down the middle, Craig Sheffield, that part. And it's just their lives growing up together. And the fact that the river is where they all have the one harmony. Because they go fishing. But it's the cinematography that I thought was outstanding in the movie because it's beautifully put together. And the story is great. Yeah, and then, of course, there's Thomas Gerrish is the dad, who's a great actor. And then Brenna Benson, is that how you say her name?
Yeah.
I think she's Vera at the moment on television.
That's right. Her? Very good.
Yeah. So all the people would know that it's on currently, I believe. So it's a family life telling a lovely story, honest to God. And I think it's autobiographical for McLean family, if I'm not mistaken.
And as you say, it looks absolutely beautiful. I mean, not as good as Kerry possibly, but it certainly makes you want to go to the middle of America and be
absolutely
in a forest.
Yeah, it would. I know, it would give Kerry run for his money now in places, I can tell you. I think it's the cinematography that really makes it so beautiful. And the lighting is great. And there's great ups and downs in it because when Brad Pitt is doing his bad bit, he's a bold boy and it's very, you know, it's very tense. And then he has the issues with his father who doesn't want him to go that road. And the other son is so great. And, you know, it's life, really.
Yeah.
You know, every family has a kind of a black sheep or a rogue.
They certainly do.
It was one of Brad Pitt's very early films, I believe.
Yeah, and Robert Redford directed it, and it's a great movie for someone who was known as, you know, just an actor primarily. He's done wonderful things behind the camera.
He did a fantastic thing on the producing of it, you know what I mean? It's just lovely. It's just a lovely movie.
And tell me this, are you a big movie guy when you're in all these hotel rooms all over Ireland and the world?
I never watch. I like the cinema. Now, I could go to London, all right, tomorrow, Monday, say, all right, for... work, and I could work like I could have three meetings, 11 o'clock, 2 and 4. Mm-hmm. And if I'm out of that meeting at 5 o'clock, I will do three movies before I go to bed.
Right.
I could do like at 5 o'clock, I could do a 7:30 and a 9:15. And I'd time them up and I'd be all set before I get near London, I'd have it all worked out. And I'd pick the cinema near the other cinema so I wouldn't have to walk far because I'm in Kenmare and our nearest cinema is Clarny, which is a great cinema, but I rarely go there. I think I've only been there once because you have to drive over and drive back and it's 20 miles over and 20 miles back. And I don't bother with that. And I love Leicester Square. You know the big theatre in Leicester Square? Oh, I'd pay any money. And if there are robbers out there because I think it's £20 now. I just love the cinema. I just love that cinema because the screen is so fantastic. Wraps around you nearly, you know.
So you're planning your cinema viewing on the plane over?
I would be watching. Oh, no, I'd have it done. Oh, before that, because the plane would be too late. I wouldn't be able to look up things on the plane. I'd look up West End cinemas now, say today, and I'd see what's on. Now, we've been devoid of cinema for the last few months. There hasn't been anything available, as you know.
Yeah.
So, and I haven't been great on the television. I watch Netflix more than anything because it's just handy as against going in and looking for other stuff. Although the Curzon in London, they have a very good site with very good movies, which is pay per movie, but it's great.
Yeah.
I've done that a few times as well. But no, I like the big cinema. I like to go to the cinema. I go on my own mostly.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with that.
No, and I could cry my eyes out depending on.
Have you ever acted?
Oh, no, never.
No, because some people would say you're quite dramatic, you know?
Yeah. No, I know. I've heard that in life before, right? No, so I'm acting every day in the hotel, I suppose.
Yeah. Something else about you. You seem to, you know, a lot of people have, like, if you take someone like Bobby Kerr of This Parish, you know, he's a,
yeah, he Bobby, a I know Bobby. Yeah,
coffee magnet, and then he becomes a radio presenter. And there are lots of people who've done other things in life. And although you're still a hotelier, you became this TV personality, you know, not in the first bloom of youth, let's say.
No.
You seem to be really enjoying it, though. That comes off the screen. Are you? Is it kind of a happy accident that you never expected?
Absolutely, 100%, because I didn't do any I've done television bits over the years, of course, because when the hotel opened back in 1980 and all that, you do bits and pieces, right? But I didn't do any serious television until I was 54.
Yeah.
When I did a documentary, Building a House in Kenmare, which was very good television, because we had trouble planning and we had to cancel, you name it. We had to talk with all of them. So it was good television. But that was the first time I ever did. And Grainne Bacalier from RT was involved with that programme. And then when Wildell Media, who are the company that does the after service television show, which is the most popular part probably, but they came to RT, she said, we'll do that show, but I will only do it if you get Frances Brennan. So they had to twist my arm 10 times to do it, because I wasn't keen at the start. But then I did do it, and so the rest is history then.
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. And At Your Service is going to come back. You're currently filming that, but it's obviously a bit different given all that's going on.
No, we're doing 4 one-hour shows.
Okay.
Okay. Stretching from Dunmore East to Wicklow to Dunlow and Donegal, and then Waterville here in Kerry, actually. All right, so we're doing 4 one-hour shows. We had great fun filming, you know, when we started filming 3 weeks ago, all COVID, under the COVID, because the production company, I had to do homework and everything. So early to God, I wasn't, and answer 30 questions to a kind of a one-hour online thing. I'm sure I couldn't get 30 questions right. I had to do it 10 times. So I put in A when it was C and D when it was E, and oh my God. But anyway, I passed anyway in the end. That's all I needed, to be certificate to get on. To go on to go out on shoot, you had to do it.
Right.
So we started in Dunmore East, and then I said, and what are we going to do about the match? Because the show definitely won't go out until the autumn of next year.
Okay.
Because there's two big projects, and they won't be ready till June or July, so it won't be a summer show. It'll be an autumn show, I'm sure, next year. But the problem with it was we had to, I said then, does anybody want to know anything about COVID next September, 12 months at that time? You know what I mean? Like, we don't need to be reminded, people. So then we did all the arrivals with a mask on and with a mask off. So we have both in the can.
Okay.
Forever. And then we social distance 100% on camera, which doesn't, that if you're, we were using two cameras, and we usually only use one, okay, but we used two because of this. So you don't notice we're so far apart. You know,
okay.
We are actually 2 meters apart at all times virtually.
Well, it sounds like a lot of thought went into it.
Yeah, it was. Well, that was the production company that did all that. But Maggie and Wildell Media was very good to us. She had us all out. But it was fine. It's been fine. It's fine.
Yeah, as you say, you have your COVID cert, so you're COVID ready, you know?
Oh, listen, I'm ready to go anywhere now.
Yeah, absolutely. Come in and put up shelves.
Me cert and hit the road.
And then finally, I have to talk to you about the new book, The Homekeeper's Diary.
Oh, yeah.
So from what I understand, this is like, there's anecdotes about your own kind of various, not kind of mishaps around the house and the hotel over the years, but also a way for people to get a little better at keeping their house clean.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's not a cleaning book. It's not a do this or do that. It's like kind of a mix of everything in a chronological order. Okay. Because we start out at the front of the book with about 20 pages, which do things like your doctor's name, your blood type, your PPS number, the plumber's number, so that when the flood starts, you know where to go to get the number, because you know yourself, if the sink bursts or something happens, or the tank in the attic, like, you're all running around the house. We had a plumber 2 years ago. Who was he? Was he Johnny? Was he Joe? So we have all those things put together in a thing. Then we have all the things there in the front of that book about, like, weights and measures, distance, miles to kilometres, all that carry-on that people would find helpful. We have, like, I think it's 60, if I'm not mistaken, symbols for the washing machine.
Okay.
Imagine. So there's no excuse. You won't be putting your blue undies in with your white shirt, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Okay. So that sort of carry on. And then we go on. Then we start a 12-month calendar. And it's a week calendar. When you open the book and put it, and it's lies flat. It's one of those books that's not popping up all the time. That was another thing I was conscious of, speaking to the printer. I said, we want a lies flat book. We don't want one that pops up. So anyway, it's lies flat, and it's 7 days. So when you look at it, you see 7 days. And then every month has a preamble about things. Like, say we were talking about the spring. Well, we had rhubarb, and we had lettuces, and what to plant at that time of the year. And then when you go to the spring, we have the blackberries and the sloes and all those sort of things. So we have it mentioned as you go along so that you know it's coming up. and then we tell you to make your Christmas cake in November.
Okay.
But a Christmas cake never refuses a glass of whiskey. So so you can have your glass of whiskey over your Christmas cake, and it'll be nicer on Christmas Day than it was ever before. So we do things like that, and it's, and then there's loads of helpful hints as you go through. So,
yeah.
You know, things like how to change a plug, you know, cleaning your oven.
Right.
Things, all sorts of things that are just helpful for people. And just, it's an ideal present for anybody. Really,
a stocking filler, as they say in the business.
Yes,
wonderful.
It would be perfect for that, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And if it's a success, which I think it already is, because it's out 10 days and we're doing very well, we might do it every year, you know, because then people will get used to that diary.
Absolutely. We'll come to depend on it. Much like we've come to depend on you, Francis.
Well, I won't say that, but people enjoy what I do. So that's great. To make somebody's day a little happier, isn't that a wonderful thing?
Well, you've made our listeners a little happier. His favourite movie is A River Runs Through It. Francis Brennan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It's 2,000 miles away. I've got more than a dozen papers there. You'd be right in the middle of things. What do you say? Come with us.
Oh, I'll never leave Montana, brother.
As time passed, my father struggled for more to hold on to, asking me again and again had I told him everything. And finally, I said to him, maybe all I really know about Paul is that he was a fine fisherman. You know more than that, my father said. He was beautiful. And that was the last time we ever spoke of my brother's death.
A clip there of A River Runs Through It. An interesting choice from the ever-interesting Francis Brennan. And my thanks to him. That's it for this week. Next week on the show, I will be talking to Mark Rylance. Yes, about the new Netflix movie, which we reviewed a few weeks ago, but is landing on Netflix, The Trial of the Chicago 7. Interesting guy. Stay tuned for that next week. Just to remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the Newstalk app, or wherever you choose to get your podcast. It's also on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. I'm open all week long on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. Leave you with some music from the movies. Before I do that, I also want to mention Anne-Marie Kane, who helped out on the show this week. Thank you, Anne-Marie. Music from the movies, big music story of the week was, of course, the sad passing of Eddie Van Halen, the man behind the band Van Halen, even though they had a few different singers along the way. And, you know, you've probably heard this song this week somewhere on some radio station, possibly even on this one. But, you know, this is just one of the greatest rock songs ever written. And it's been used in lots of movies, too many to mention. Most of them pretty bad, actually. But this is a great song. And, you know, great advice. Why not just jump, you know? Why not? Have a great weekend.